9. Columbus, Caribs, and Cannibalism. The captain took two parrots, very large and very different from those seen before. He found much cotton spun and ready for spinning, and articles of food, and he brought away a little of everything. Especially he brought away 4 or 5 bones of the arms and legs of men. When we saw this, we suspected that the islands were those islands of the Caribbean, which are inhabited by people who eat human flesh. Dr. Diego Alvarez Chanca. The quote you just heard came from Dr. Diego Alvarez Chanca, a physician from Sevilla who accompanied Cristóbal Colombo, a.k.a. Christopher Columbus, during his second voyage to the New World in 1493. Columbus had come ashore on the island he would name Santa Maria de Guadalupe. As the landing party entered a small village, the local inhabitants fled in terror, leaving behind everything they owned. It was a response that had taken them a little over a year to develop. During his first voyage in 1492, Columbus referred to all of the native people as Indios. But by a year later, a distinction had been made between the peaceful Arawaks, also called Tainos, and another group known to the locals as the Caribs, or more commonly, Caribs. What Columbus would never know was that the indigenous inhabitants were actually a diverse assemblage that had been living on the islands for hundreds of years. Their ancestors had set out from coastal Venezuela, where the outflowing currents of the Orinoco River carried the migrants into the open sea and far beyond. At each island stop, these settlers developed their own cultures and customs, so that by the time the Spaniards arrived, the entire Caribbean island chain had already been colonized, with settlements extending as far north as the Bahamas. Columbus, though, cared little about local customs or history. Instead, he noted that the Arawaks were gentle and friendly, and he wasted little time in passing this information on to his royal backers in Spain. The Arawaks are fitted to be ruled and to be set to work to cultivate the land and do all else that may be necessary. This somewhat less than friendly response led the locals to initiate some self-preservation-related finger-pointing, designed perhaps to send their new pals off on a quest to enlighten somebody else. Although no one is quite sure who was doing the translating, soon after his initial arrival, the Arawaks reportedly told Columbus that the Caribs inhabited certain of the southern islands, including those that would eventually be called St. Vincent, Dominica, Guadeloupe, and Trinidad. Columbus was informed that the Caribs were not only infamous for brutal raids against their peaceful neighbors, but also for the annoying habit of eating their captives. But pillaging and people-eating weren't the Caribs' only vices. Every year they took a break from their mayhem-related jobs in order to meet up with a tribe of warrior women. These fighting females were reportedly fierce to the last degree, strong as tigers, courageous in fight, brutal and merciless. With more than a fleeting resemblance to a race of fictional characters dreamed up by the ancient Greeks, these warrior women lived on their own island, Martinique, and killed any men they encountered, except, that is, for the Caribs, who got a yearly invite to drop by for some feasting and debauchery. Possibly the invitations stemmed from the fact that the Caribs were renowned for their cooking ability, preparing their viands by smoking them slowly on a wooden platform. It was a setup the Spanish began referring to as a barbacoa. After manning the grill and servicing the gals, the Caribs returned home, taking with them any newborn males who had shown up 9 months after the previous year's party. Female babies would, of course, remain behind with their moms to be raised as warriors. In retrospect, it is difficult to determine where Arawak tall tales ended and Columbus's vivid and self-serving imagination kicked in. What is known is that European history and folklore were already rich with references to encounters with bizarre monsters and strange human races. Although most of the stories emerging from the New World were greeted with enthusiasm back in Sevilla, some of Columbus's patrons expressed skepticism after hearing that the Caribs also hunted with schools of fish. These had been trained to accept tethers and dispatched with instructions to latch onto sea turtles, which could then be reeled in for butchering. Easier to accept, perhaps, were Columbus's claims that some Caribs had dog-like faces, reminiscent of the cynocephaly described nearly 1,400 years earlier by Pliny the Elder, the Roman author and naturalist. Still, other New World locals were said to possess a single centrally located eye, or long tails, appendages that necessitated the digging of holes by their owners so that they might sit down. These creatures were considered anything but a joke, since as late as 1758, Linnaeus's opus Systema Naturae listed three species of man: Homo sapiens, wise man; Homo troglodyte, caveman; and Homo caudatus, tailed man. But whether or not these strange savages had tails, and even if they were supported by trained fish and Amazonian girlfriends, plans were soon being formulated to pacify the Caribs, who were now being referred to as Canibs. According to scholars, the transition from Carib to Canib apparently resulted from a mispronunciation. Although, in light of stories describing locals as having canine faces, I agree with Yale professor Claude Rawson that Canib may also be a degenerate form of canis, Latin for dog. Eventually, Canib became the root of cannibal, which replaced anthropophagi, the ancient Greek mouthful previously used to describe people-eaters. But whatever the locals were called, and however the term cannibal may have originated, the first part of Columbus's grand plan centered on relieving them of the abundant gold he knew they had in their possession. One reason for Columbus's certainty on this point was the commonly held belief that silver formed in cold climates while gold was created in warm or hot regions. And considering the heat and humidity of the New World tropics, this could only mean that there would be plenty of the shiny stuff around. Unlike his first voyage, which consisted of three ships and 120 men, Columbus's second visit to the New World had the look of a military occupation force. Accompanying him were 17 ships and nearly 1,500 men, many of them heavily armed. Although he had begun to look at slave raiding as a means to finance his voyages, his prime directive was to find gold, lots of it. To facilitate the collection of what Columbus assumed would be a massive treasure, he levied tribute on those living in regions like El Cibao, in what is now the northern part of the Dominican Republic. His orders stated that every male between 14 and 70 years of age was to collect and turn over a substantial measure of gold to his representatives every 3 months. Those who failed at what quickly became an impossible task had their hands hacked off. Anyone who chose to flee was hunted down, the Spaniards encouraging their vicious war dogs to tear apart any escapees they could track down. In the end, very little of the precious metal was turned in. Presumably, the island residents, under the very real threat of losing their limbs or being eaten alive by giant dogs, quickly ran through any gold they might have had on hand. Since it played only a small role, or no role at all, in their traditions, in all likelihood the locals just didn't know where to find it, especially in the quantities demanded by the Spanish invaders. Deeply disappointed at the meager results, Columbus penned a letter to his royal supporters in Spain in May 1499. In it, he wondered why God our Lord has concealed the gold from us. There is no record of a response, but Columbus soon refocused his efforts toward the collection of a resource that was available in great supply: humans. In 1503, this bloodthirsty new take on the exploration of the New World got a significant boost when the self-proclaimed Admiral of the Ocean Sea received a royal proclamation from Queen Isabella. In it, she stated that those locals who did not practice cannibalism should be free from slavery and mistreatment. More significantly, though, she also instructed Columbus and his men about what they could do to them if they were determined to be cannibals. If such cannibals continue to resist and do not wish to admit and receive to their lands the captains and men who may be on such voyages by my orders, nor to hear them in order to be taught our sacred Catholic faith and to be in my service and obedience, they may be captured and are taken to these my kingdoms and domains and to other parts and places and be sold. This new position was given even more support by the Catholic Church several years later, when Pope Innocent IV decreed in 1510 that not only was cannibalism a sin, but that Christians were perfectly justified in doling out punishment for cannibalism through force of arms. What happened next was as predictable as it was terrible. On islands where no cannibalism had been reported previously, man-eating was suddenly determined to be a popular practice. Regions inhabited by peaceful Arawaks were, upon re-examination, found to be crawling with man-eating Caribs, and very soon the line between the two groups was obliterated. Resistance and cannibalism became synonymous, and anyone acting aggressively toward the Europeans was immediately labeled as a cannibal. In an effort to organize the cannibal pacification efforts, Rodrigo de Figueroa, the former governor of Santo Domingo, now the Dominican Republic, was given the job of making judgments on the official classification of all the indigenous groups encountered by the Spanish during their takeover. Testimonials and other evidence were used to place the cannibalism tag on island populations. And by a strange coincidence, the designations seemed to change with the priorities of the Spanish for the islands in question. Trinidad, for example, was declared a cannibal island in 1511, but the ruling was changed in 1518. Rather than relating to concerns over the welfare of the local people, though, the reclassification came about because of reports of gold in Trinidad and the Spaniards' desire to maintain the local population for use in mining operations. It was more than coincidental, then, that once the Spanish mining efforts on Trinidad failed to produce any gold, reports began filtering in that the locals were cannibals after all. Soon after, the order was given to colonize Trinidad and to depopulate it of its remaining man-eating inhabitants. As a result, the pre-Columbian indigenous population in Trinidad, estimated to be somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 individuals, dropped to half that number within 100 years. Even in places that hadn't initially been designated as cannibal islands, populations dropped precipitously as the locals were either hauled off to toil as slaves, were murdered, or died from newly arrived diseases like measles, smallpox, and influenza. The latter may have been a form of swine flu carried by some pigs that Columbus had picked up on the Canary Islands during the early part of his second voyage. According to historian David Stannard, wherever the marauding, diseased, and heavily armed Spanish forces went out on patrol, accompanied by ferocious armored dogs that had been trained to kill and disembowel, they preyed on the local communities, already plague-enfeebled, forcing them to supply food and women and slaves and whatever else the soldiers might desire. The diseases the Spaniards carried, the precise identities of which are still debated, spread with alarming speed through local communities, killing inhabitants in numbers that, according to one writer at the time, could not be counted. Stannard believes that by the end of the 16th century, the Spanish had been directly or indirectly responsible for the deaths of between 60 and 80 million indigenous people in the Caribbean, Mexico, and Central America. Even if one were to discount the millions of deaths resulting from diseases, this would still make the Spanish conquest of the New World the greatest act of genocide in recorded history. These types of numbers, which are subject to considerable academic debate, are often overlooked during Columbus Day parades and related festivities. In the end, tall tales, especially those with bestial or cannibalistic angles, effectively dehumanized the islanders. Not only did this serve to justify Spain's rapidly evolving slave-raiding agenda, but it also established a mindset toward the locals that came to resemble pest control. Leaving behind neither pyramids nor stone glyphs, the indigenous cultures of the Caribbean have all but disappeared.